Many people in our food community have been seriously impacted by Superstorm Sandy, and our hearts go out to them. At HRN, we've been covering these stories since the storm hit. To learn more, visit our website at www.heritageradionetwork.org. The following program has been brought to you by Rolling Press, a family-run, eco-friendly printing company. For more information, visit rollingpress.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Burning Down the House on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. As you who are good listeners, regular listeners, know, I've frequently spoken about the interconnectedness of everything. One of my favorite topics is the interrelations between architecture, which Goethe called frozen music, and actual music. And those of you who are theory geeks or history buffs know that Vitruvius, in his books on architecture in the first century BC, wrote about the proper tuning of musical instruments, because back in those days, there was no distinction between having a geometrical education, which was necessary to be able to plan and construct buildings, and a musical education. And moreover, in times of war, and we know that the Romans were always at war, it was the architect's job to tune the war machines. Yeah, they had catapult-like, well, they had the trebuchet. Well, everybody knows that. You've seen that on the Discovery Channel. But they also had huge crossbow-like machines called scorpions with many different cables holding a projectile. And the way to know that the machine was properly tensioned was to play the strings and listen to the tune. And Vitruvius goes on and on and on about all the different tunings, which is a bit arcane for us in these days. Now, today we're going to speak with a real musician, my good friend George Naha, whom I met a long time ago, back in the 20th century. George and I were freshmen together at the Cooper Union for the Advancement of Science and Art. Welcome to Burning Down the House, George.
CB, it's my pleasure to be here, and it's great to see you. After
yeah, you know, you lost your rock and roll hair, man, but then so did I.
Well, you know, these things happen.
Yes, I know. Eventually you grow up, but we're not too old to rock and roll, and we're certainly way too young to die.
You bet.
I wanted to ask you how things have been going. You just sort of disappeared from the landscape there down at Cooper Square.
Well, yeah, by about the middle of my second year, I really felt like I really have to do what I wanted to do in the beginning, which was pursue a career in music.
Yeah, and you were already really an excellent guitarist at that
time. Well, thank you. Thanks.
I mean, I remember you were taking lessons with Tal Farlow.
Actually, Harry Leahy, who was a great, great, great guitar player and teacher who... legend had it that between Harry and another fellow named Joe Cinderella, who just passed away, the story was they taught the entire state of New Jersey how to play the guitar. They divided up the state, and I think Joe got the north half and Harry got the south. So it was.
So where are you from in Jersey?
I grew up in Linden, New Jersey.
Where's that?
It's in Union County.
Oh, so it's up north.
Yeah, it's like next to Elizabeth, New Jersey, uh-huh. Right off of Route 1, out right by the oil tanks.
Aha! Uh-huh. How... How interesting.
The Bayway Refinery was a stone's throw, so to speak.
How'd you cope with the odor of the the refineries that are near there?
Well, you know, it wasn't all that bad. The one night one of the tanks blew up, and that was kind of hard to take.
Wow. Very interesting.
Well, I'll never forget that night. I was practicing my guitar, and I thought I heard a sound. I thought someone was driving up my driveway, and all of a sudden the nighttime sky turned orange.
Wow.
And I go, this usually doesn't happen, And then the house shook, and that was it. There was a huge tank that blew at the Bayway Refinery.
Oh, my God. So, well, I did my Jersey time.
Did you? Where were
from,
you?
From sixth grade to through college. Well, actually, my parents were there through college years, but I graduated from Shore Regional High School in West Long Branch.
West Long Branch, uh-huh.
In Monmouth County.
Okay, now any idea how did Long Branch fare with Sandy?
Not well.
No? Well, that's sad.
Boardwalk got totally ripped up.
Oh, boy.
A lot of flooding.
Mm-hmm.
A friend of mine who's from down there, totally from there.
Mm-hmm.
I was just passing through. posted some photos, and if you remember, well, the coastline has these lakes that have been, they I guess were mostly inlets into the ocean, but they've been closed off. And the lake in between Asbury Park and Interlaken was totally into the ocean.
Oh, my.
And, you know, Ocean Avenue goes up along through there, through Allenhurst and all that, totally underwater.
Oh.
Really quite impressive, quite impressive. So you just took a sidestep, went back fully into music. Did you go to conservatory?
Well, it's interesting. When I was in high school, I got a guitar in 1967, and I practiced a lot, and I learned how to play rock and roll songs, and I learned my chords, and I was playing about 6 months, and I knew all my open position chords, and my brother was 2 years older than me. He had a band with old guys. They were almost ready to go to college.
Wow.
They were old.
Yeah.
And he let me play with these old guys. And so I started learning more from these more experienced musicians, and I wanted to be a music major. And I told my parents, I want to be a music major. And my dad, who worked all his life in factories, and I don't want to be in play. Let's say he broke his back for a living. And he said to me, music, that's a tough life, you know. And I wanted to do it. And I tried to get into... it was Newark State College at the time in the music program.
Mm-hmm.
And I could play what I could play, but I never studied. I couldn't read a note, so yeah, I didn't get in. Now, somehow I wound up in Cooper Union. I still can't explain to you how
somehow.
That happened. Well, I don't know how that happened.
People shit bricks thinking that, you know, oh my God, you know, I got to go and I'll never get in.
I don't know.
Very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I took the placement tests and I wrote my essays and I did this and that and I was accepted. So for... You know, I lasted about 3 semesters, but the whole time I was there, I was really thinking, I want to play guitar, I want to play guitar. So by about the, you know, middle of the second year there, I really said, this is it. And then I was able to get into Newark State College. I had been studying with Harry Leahy on the guitar, and I auditioned the second time at Newark State, got in, but they forced me to play classical guitar, which was not to my liking at all. So I lasted about a year there, took a year off, and I finished up at Rutgers, Livingston College, which had a great jazz program at the time. So I got out of there in 76.
That's not bad.
Yeah, it took me about seven years and 3 colleges to get a BA, but I was persistent. And I started teaching there. When I was still a student, they hired me to teach guitar at the school. And I did that until about 1980. And then I got a chance to go out on the road playing basically on the Chitlin' circuit with Sam and Dave and Wilson Pickett and Junior Walker and the All-Stars. So I did the whole soul circuit for quite a few years. And I just kept going and going and going, and here I am.
What were you, like the token white guy or what?
Well, there were a few of us here and there, but there was a point when I was the only one of the Caucasian persuasion left in some of the bands. But... what was that?
What was that?
I don't know.
That was exciting.
Someone's jamming our signal.
Yeah. We haven't even dropped any F-bombs yet.
Give us time. But I have to say, though, playing on the Chitlin' circuit, it was wonderful. I mean, playing all those places with all those guys that actually made those great rhythm and blues records for those years, it was a wonderful experience.
So would you like to... play a little Sam and Dave for us?
Well, you know, their big one that they did, of course, started with the great Steve Cropper lick when he played etc. So, you know, I did that stuff for years, and I worked with Wilson Pickett and Junior Walker. And then later I went on, I actually got to play with guys like Steve Cropper and Bernard Purdy and Cornell Dupree, all the players that were my idols in that style of music. I wound up recording with them and touring with them and becoming a part of that circle. So it's...
Wow.
I've been very fortunate. I've been very blessed.
I bow before you.
Well...
No, this is real. This is serious music. This is seriously musical. this is professional.
Well, I feel very fortunate that I was accepted as a member of those musical communities. And, you know, I still to this day get emails here and there from Steve Cropper, and we chat with each other here and there. And many of the people that were my musical heroes when I was listening and discovering these records, they're now my friends and people that I've played and recorded with. So,
wow. Now, that scene, I really bow down before that. Yeah, I grew up in a musical family. It was expected that I would have to learn an instrument.
Uh-huh.
And so my grandfather, who was a conductor and a music teacher,
mm-hmm.
Taught me how to play cornet.
Oh, okay.
And I still have the dirty old, you know, 80-year-old horn by now mm-hmm. that he gave me. It's got a great tone. It's easy to play. Looks like crap. Sounds good.
Uh-huh.
And
do you play it much?
Not as much as I should. I mean, mm-hmm. If you don't play every day, your lip goes, and then
sure.
you're shot. And
sure.
you, I mean, if you don't have the embouchure,
mm-hmm.
forget about it. Mm-hmm. A couple of years ago, a friend of mine from Cooper, mm-hmm. Nick Agneta,
uh-huh.
who was in a couple different bands. He's a really, really talented keyboardist, but he happens also to be an architect.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, and I don't think he would disagree, I think he's a better musician than he is an architect.
Okay.
But he's a self-taught keyboard musician,
mm-hmm.
and he transposes in a snap. Anyway, they had a pickup band for, and they do this frequently, for Dylan's birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And they needed some backup brass on Rainy Day Women.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I practiced for a week. I got a little bit of my lip back.
Uh-huh.
It's dirty playing. But
that's a great record. A great,
yeah,
great
so you know, I was fine for uh-huh. one song.
Blow out your chops with the one song?
Yeah, well, pretty much. but, you know, as things happen... you get into high school, you get into your teens.
Uh-huh.
I think it was 68 or 69 when I bought my first guitar for $59.
Oh, my.
It was a lot of money for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I still have it. It's really not playable because over the years it's kind of bent, you know.
I can imagine the bow on that neck
yeah.
right now. You might be able to use it as a scorpion.
Yeah, that's right. Just... then about 4 years ago, I had a really good job, and I thought, you know, I deserve a real instrument.
Mm-hmm.
I went to the Guitar Center. I said, I have that one.
Uh-huh.
This one.
That was a beautiful guitar.
It's a very nice guitar.
Mm-hmm.
Martin makes a very nice guitar. Now, problem is, I can't really play very well. I played much better when I was in college, and I was hanging around with all these folky people. And
mm-hmm.
we used to go and... you know, get drunk with Dave Von Runk.
Ah.
Because you can do that.
Sure.
Or you could do that then, because it was the village, right?
Right, right,
you know?
Right, right.
Poor Dave. You know, what a life.
Mm-hmm. What a talented man.
Fantastic. Really great.
Mm-hmm.
So, but see, you got real music practical theory. I grew up with a grandfather who was, you know, a temperamental maestro type.
Mm-hmm.
And he was damned if I was not going to escape his clutches without getting... Every year I got the... At Easter, I got uh-huh. the same lecture.
Uh-huh.
major mode, minor mode,
uh-huh.
Dorian scale, thirds and fifths and octaves.
Uh-huh.
And really none of it made any sense until I got into architecture school. Mm-hmm. And we started studying the Renaissance.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, there was this architect and theoretician called Alberti.
Okay.
And he did a pretty famous Santa Maria Novella, is the name of it, in Florence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all based on a theory that ties musical intervals to proportion.
Okay.
And at that time, they were all fully versed in the mathematical work that a guy named Fibonacci, in, I think in the 1100s,
mm-hmm.
had discovered
mm-hmm.
the sequence of numbers, 0, 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, and so forth, where mm-hmm. any two numbers added together gives you the next number in the series.
Mm-hmm.
And oddly enough, 1, 3, 5, and 8.
Okay, there's your chord.
There's your chord.
Right.
There's your fundamental, your third, your fifth, and your octave.
Right.
Well, although an octave is actually 12.
That's true.
Half steps.
Right. Well, okay. Who's counting?
Well, that's right. and it suddenly all came together.
Uh-huh.
So, should we attempt to try to play something?
I'd love to play some music with you.
Okay. What... I see you brought your Telecaster. You got your little Fender amp.
Yep.
You got a pedal. What kind of effects do you have on that pedal?
This is a very simple pedal. It's made by a guy out in Connecticut, Analog Mike. He has a company called Analog Man, and they hand make these pedals.
Wow.
And the pedal that I have today is called the King of Tone. And I have a Tone King amplifier, so there's a lot of royalty in my musical lineage right now.
Okay, you got kings.
I was thinking of putting a throne in my Toyota Corolla just when I could take this stuff to gigs. But
that'd be pretty funny.
It would be beautiful. It would be the Solomon Burke model Corolla with a big throne in it and tying it to R&B. But we're coming full circle here at the beginning of the show.
Yeah, we like to do that.
Yeah, we're good at this.
Yeah, that's good.
So... one side of the pedal is just a clean boost. I'll demonstrate it very quickly. Here, I'll shut the pedal off, and I'll just strum a chord through the amplifier. Nice, clean tone.
Now,
if I wanted to play that sound for maybe a solo, but I thought, well, I need a little bit more boost on it. Just not much dirt, but just a little more sound. Here it is clean. Here it is boosted.
A little overtone.
Yeah, so it's slightly louder, slightly wider, and you could take a clean-sounding solo, but cut through the band a little better. The other side is actually an overdrive unit, and that can crank up pretty much. I don't want to crank too much because I don't want to overblow any mics or anything. But here we have a clean sound, and now I can just dirty it up a little bit. So it just gives you... kind of a bluesier, like that kind of a thing.
Nice.
So
so you could do a little John Lee Hooker with that.
Well, yeah, that kind of brings you into that.
If you've just tuned in, this is Burning Down the House, not your usual thing. Usually we talk about design, architecture, and the creative arts. Today we're talking about performing arts, the performance of music and architecture, and somehow they do have some things in common with George Naha, former architecture student and professional guitarist. If you give me, like three stupid chords that I could play.
Sure.
I could handle three chords, and you could... play something bluesy over that.
Sure. Well, any key you're happy with. I know you were talking about doing maybe the...
Oh, yeah, but I suddenly have butterflies. I could talk all day long. I could talk to 10,000 people, 50,000, a million people about architecture, but when it comes to actually, like, music, it's like, oh, my God, the ghost of my grandfather is, like, standing behind me saying, you better play the notes right.
Do you need me to shoo him away?
It'd be nice.
I'll work.
Well, there was this. Thank you. everywhere is freaks and Harrys, dykes and fairies. Down there, where is sanity? Tax the rich, feed the poor, till there are no rich no more. But I don't know what to do. So I'll leave it all to you. Population keeps on breathing, nation breathing. Life is funny, as it's sunny. Bees make honey, who needs money? I'd love to change the world, but I don't know what to do. I leave it all to you. There's no solution. Institution electrocution. Black and white, rich or poor, them and us, stop the wars. But I don't know what to do. So I'll leave it all to you. It was fun.
Yeah.
I don't know any other songs other than Kumbaya and...
what key?
But back in the 20th century, when I used to live in a village, there were a lot of folky people. And,
sure.
And, you know, your basic... a banjo is... pretty much tuned the same way as if you were playing on the black keys, and there you go with the Dorian mode again.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of this D minor stuff. Always because I just can't leave well enough alone. I was always playing with trying to transpose banjo tunes to the guitar.
Oh, okay.
For a while, I was really good at claw hammer picking.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I probably was totally infected by the absolutely fantastic technique of Richard Thompson.
Oh, what an amazing musician.
Yeah, right? Who I was happy to see twice 2 years running.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he'll play with his pick and then
right.
pick with his other fingers. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's just fantastic.
Right, right. He's a wonderful guitar player.
And he goes all over the Mac between folk rock, Celtic stuff. And mm-hmm. of course, he was founders of Fairport Convention.
Also great songwriter and just an all-around amazing musical person.
Yeah, highly underappreciated. Mm-hmm. He kind of disappeared for a while, but now he's been touring and, never better.
Mm-hmm. That's one nice thing about music, I think, that if you're lucky and you take relatively good care of yourself, your technique really doesn't go down much as you age.
Oh, no. I mean, Arthur Rubinstein, any great musician,
right.
They keep it up,
right.
They're only going to be better. They're going to be more musical.
I heard one great thing with Arthur Rubinstein once. They were saying, "Oh, maestro, you were so wonderful at the piano tonight." And he was very humble about his gift. I mean, it was an amazing gift. And his typical line would be, "I left more notes under the piano than came out today." You know? I always liked that line, you know.
I remember another thing attributed to him, which is if I don't practice for one day,
mm-hmm.
I will notice. If I don't practice for 2 days, you will notice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which you have to. I mean, you must have to practice every day, don't you? Pretty much.
Well, I certainly try to. I mean, right now I'm in the middle of prepping my house for sale, so I'm doing more spackling than picking. But
that's a problem.
Yeah, it's not the greatest thing for your chops, but it's fine. I keep my technique in pretty good shape. I try.
Well, spackling. I could tell you all about spackling technique. The bigger the knife, the better.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have one of those big 12-inch blades?
Yeah, I don't. I should. All I had to do the other day, I was just fixing up. My house has sheetrock,
mm-hmm.
and just where some of the seams are, unfortunately, we had a guy years ago from ADT that came in to install an alarm system. He kind of looked like a carny, and he did this when he was putting in the motion sensor. He was like having his way with our walls, and he left some cracks. So they were just hairline cracks. So I just with a narrow putty knife, I just filled them all in and sanded them down. So
uh-huh.
It wasn't anything too bad I had to do, but it's different technique.
Yeah,
than playing a Telecaster.
Well. Yeah, well, that's true. Yeah. There are many times I'd rather be just screwing around with the guitar,
mm-hmm.
Or trying to figure out a new, the chords to a new song,
uh-huh,
instead
uh-huh.
of doing architecture. I think that it's important to, however, to do things in phases.
Mm-hmm.
There's this terrific video of John Cleese that's mm-hmm. been going around.
Okay.
I think I might have sent you a link to it. He talks about creativity and the importance of just playing
mm-hmm.
with an idea, just, crazy stuff.
Right.
And giving yourself the space and the time
mm-hmm.
on a regular basis where you're just playing
right.
and you're not under an obligation to have to solve anything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way that we learn.
You know, it's true. There's also a wonderful book out called Effortless Mastery by Kenny Werner, who's a master jazz pianist.
Mm.
And he was saying to get to the next level as a musician, he said, even if you're a working professional musician, very often you have music you have to prepare, by a certain time or date for a certain gig. You get it as good as you can. You really work at it, and then you do your gig, and then you might not ever play that music again.
Mm-hmm.
So you've gotten it up to a certain level. You do it. It came out as good as you get it. And then they pay you, hopefully. And you go home. And but he said to really get great at something with music, you have to take certain music and put it in a special place where there's no time constraint, where you're not saying, I have to have this at a certain level by a certain time.
Mm-hmm.
Where you, like you're saying, you open up the space of just freedom where you're feeling very relaxed and expansive about experimenting with things and just playing them without thinking, oh my God, I have to have this together by February. Because once you start that, you bring anxiety into your life. And then
you're done.
Yeah. Well, it's not the greatest thing for your psyche. It's not the greatest thing for your performance. So it's nice to go to a place with certain musical passages or songs that you're working on. Just say, I'm just going to keep working on these. You know, just raise what you can do, and it's the same spirit of play.
Oh yeah, I just had a thought, and it's mm-hmm. not necessarily following what you're saying,
uh-huh.
but Well, two things. Sure. One is the worst is when you have second thoughts or regrets about what you could have done if you'd given yourself a little bit more time.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is that sometimes great music is very rough.
It's absolutely true.
The original blues, the Mississippi Delta blues, mm-hmm. before it migrated up into Memphis,
mm-hmm.
And then eventually up to Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
It's incredibly rough.
It certainly is.
And incredibly beautiful.
Unbelievably expressive.
Yeah, which then, for no particular reason, mm-hmm. makes me think of the really kind of crappy playing, mm-hmm. no offense, of Lou Reed early on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, three-chord songs that are fabulous, you know, mm-hmm. like Sweet Jane.
Sure, sure.
Which in Lou's case, I guess, it kind of had to be easy to play because I think he had some pharmacological challenges.
You're kidding.
I heard a rumor. I mean, I can't imagine that. I mean, everybody knows that musicians are the cleanest people. That I mean, we're practically like priests and nuns, right?
Well, the priest thing, you know.
I don't know about like nuns
in the light of day.
Yeah, without all the anger and the rulers. Right.
But it's true what you're saying. I had a great when I was at Livingston College. Had a great guitar teacher who was also really my mentor. His name was Ted Dunbar.
Uh-huh.
Ted was a fascinating guy. He was a great guitarist, a self-taught guitar player, but he also played trumpet.
Wow.
And he was also a pharmacist, tying this all in.
A pharmacist?
Yes, he was a licensed pharmacist in a few different states. He had his degree in pharmacy. But he was this wonderful, very creative jazz guitar player. And one of the things he said to us, if you're going to improvise, it's going to be sloppy.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, when you're creating on the moment, so it's like when we're having a conversation, we're not pre-planning each word that we say.
No.
And not every word is going to come out shaped perfectly. It's good, but it's a conversation.
Yeah.
We're improvising.
Yeah.
And he said the same thing with music. He said, it has to be sloppy. And his analogy was one, I'll never forget it. He goes, what's the most creative thing a person can do? And we said, I don't know, what is it? He goes, create another person. And he said, have you ever seen a baby being born?
Oh, yeah.
He goes, they don't come out dry cleaned. So he said, that's the most creative endeavor a person can take part in, and it's very sloppy, but it's
isn't that funny? You know, and we talk about dirty language and mm-hmm. getting down and dirty,
right,
and,
right.
and it's the most sublime thing.
It's true.
Uh-huh.
So...
Do you ever play Hendrix stuff, or is that just not your thing?
Well, you know, the Hendrix stuff I really love. I mean, you know, Jimi Hendrix, I especially liked his studio recordings. I mean, his live stuff could be incendiary, and some of it was great, but, you know, at the day, we were talking about pharmacological issues, and...
oh, yeah.
There, you could see or hear some live Hendrix where you thought... Somebody should have tuned those guitars before they got on stage. I mean, it was a different era. There were no guitar tuners back then.
Oh, yeah, right.
And, but his studio stuff, I absolutely love. And his rhythm guitar playing, I absolutely love. I think he was such a musical person. And one of the things that I like to play from Hendrix, I play this every once in a while. I do a little bit of this.
Oh, yeah.
Take it to the end. A little out of tune. But But he was just a masterful guitar player.
He was. And had he lived...
Well, that's the thing.
Yeah, he would have moved straight into more progressive jazz.
Well, allegedly he had been rehearsing with Miles Davis around the time of his death. Wow. And because I read, there's a great book out, autobiography of Miles. It was done by Quincy Troupe and Miles. And Miles was talking about they were having rehearsals with Hendrix. And, you know, Miles was quite a studied musician. He did go to Juilliard for a while. And when he was 19, he was playing with Charlie Parker. And that stuff was, bebop was not easy music to play.
No.
And Hendrix was kind of a self-taught guy that he, you know, and there was a great note in the book. Where Miles was saying he was, you know, Miles had that voice and he talked like that. Hey, Tio, you know those Miles, oh, yeah. Like, Tio, play that back, Tio. So he's telling, you know, Hendrix, hey, man, I like what you was doing on that diminished chord, man. And Hendrix looked at him like, diminished chord? What's that? You know? And but he heard music and he could play it. And then he passed away. And it was interesting, you know, Miles, who was already probably, I guess, in his 50s maybe when Hendrix passed away, read later that allegedly Hendrix was drinking wine and doing some kind of barbiturates or something and choked on vomit. And Miles, that's allegedly the story.
Yeah.
And Miles said, man, we could have told him you don't mix those two things, man. You know, so.
yeah.
But he didn't ask. You know, so, but Hendrix was, he was a game changer.
Yeah.
He was a game changer.
And so was Miles.
Oh, for sure. For many, many, many years, Miles was a game changer.
But yet. I mean, Herbie Hancock's still with us.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And
yeah, and we're blessed to have Herbie for all these years.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. Back in the 20th century, somebody was all excited. They came into school.
Mm-hmm.
They said, never going to believe this. I met Ornette Coleman on the subway. It was like, and we were talking about architecture. Oh. And Ornette said, you know... I wanted to study architecture. I think about architecture all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, think about the GM building. You know the GM building there, that Ed Stone building?
Uh-huh.
It wears lace panties. It's impossible for me to walk by there without saying, yeah, I see something showing there.
It's beautiful.
So, I mean, there's always, you know, there's always something bubbling between people who want to be architects and people who want to be musicians, and you could, you know, maybe you could do a little of both. Mm-hmm. Frank Lloyd Wright played piano.
Did he really?
Yeah. One of his sons was reminiscing about perhaps one of the most pleasant things, and apparently Mr. Wright was an unpleasant man.
From what I've read, I think.
From time to time.
Yep.
Yeah. Late in the night, he heard his father down in the studio playing Beethoven on the Steinway.
Oh, my.
And, you know... one of the things that apprentices had to do at Taliesin and West is they had to do musicales. They had to do musical presentations to Mr. and Mrs. Wright in the evening.
Really?
Everyone would dress for dinner.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, the apprentices had made dinner also. I mean, it was a great slave camp. It was a wonderful thing. And they would make presentations after dinner. And... Mr. Wright and Mrs. Wright would sit in their throne-like chairs, and people would perform.
Wow!
And I think that's very interesting. My own theory of a proper architectural education is that no one should get out of architecture school without knowing how to cook.
Uh-huh.
Because I think there's a lot to be learned by knowing ingredients and seasonings and how they work together.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the aspects of how this program fits in with the rest of Heritage Radio Network. We have all these foodies and wine people and chefs, is that we're all talking about the ingredients of life and the blend of seasonings and the proportion of things. And to be a good architect, you really have to understand the materials that are going to go into your creation.
Well, same thing, I believe, if you're like a musician and you get into the whole concept of arranging.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Because then, you know, I from time to time, I've done a lot of horn arrangements. And, it was interesting. Years ago, I guess it was around 1981, I was touring with Sam and Dave. And the horn players used to have these huge fights about what the actual parts were on the old records, the old soul records.
Really?
They'd fight. I mean, almost fisticuffs every once in a while. And I'd be like, boy, these guys are passionate about trumpet parts, you know? So I started to listen to those records myself. I said, well, let me try to figure this out. And then I got a band, I guess back in around 81 or 82. I called it The Other Mule, and we had a horn section. And I started writing out all horn arrangements just for the three pieces. And then it got more and more, and over the years, sometimes I don't do anything for years at a stretch, but then I'll get busy for a couple of recording sessions writing out a lot of stuff. And it's the same thing. You might have a certain arrangement in your head of instruments, and you're thinking, well, what would feel better here? Should that be a tenor sax on this note, or should that be a trombone? And what would happen if I did this? And with so much of music, and sometimes it's like where you have people not playing, which is more important than mm-hmm. where they do play.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're writing a horn arrangement, you might say, well, it's a spice. Like you're saying, it's a spice.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, you wouldn't give somebody 2 pounds of cinnamon for dessert. You know,
No.
But you sprinkle a little cinnamon on something, they go, wow.
Yeah, and that classic Sam and Dave stuff, the horns only come in every so often. They're
sure.
not playing all the time.
Oh, no, no.
But then if you look at orchestral work,
mm-hmm.
The brass section is largely just sitting out.
Right, right.
You know, whoa. The woeful life of a French horn player.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you might have a couple of solo lines to do, but the rest of the time you're just part of the bass line.
But when they come in and they do, well, they're an essential part of it, and when they come in with that beautiful color that only a French horn can create, it's a very important part of the music.
Yes. So could you play some Sam and Dave stuff for us? You know, a couple minutes of that? That would be nice.
Sure. Hang on. If you give me a second, I just want to recheck my tunes very quickly.
No, it's fine.
Because the room did warm up a bit.
It did.
And strings. Now, this is an interesting story while I'm doing this. I used to sub on a Broadway show years ago called Song and Dance. It was an Andrew Lloyd Webber show. And what very often in Broadway theaters, they start off fairly cold.
Oh, yeah.
And, well, they pump up the AC because they're going to shut the AC off during the performance.
Exactly.
And then the audience comes in, so the theater gets warmer and warmer.
Right.
And, of course, with guitars and all the string instruments, as your instrument warms up, you're going flat. Now, with brass instruments, as it's getting warmer, you're going sharp.
Right.
So there was this one passage right at the end of Act 1 where the guitar tuner doesn't seem to work.
Well, I'll get it. You can use mine.
That sounds good enough. This is fine. That's okay, Curtis. I got it.
All right.
So, but there was a passage at the end of Act 1 where the first guitar and the trumpet were doubled this high F. Well, I knew. I mean, I had a tuner that mm-hmm. was built into my pedals that I could click off the sound, still tune. I tuned constantly. Oh, thank you, man. Let me see. There we go. So I can actually clip this onto the headstock, right?
Yep. Yeah.
And plus it builds up strength in my left hand.
That's right. Well, as if you need it.
That one looks good. So at any rate, what do you say there? Okay. We're looking good.
It's a little slow.
Okay. Well, it's okay. I am too. We're getting older.
Shh.
Shh. We don't mention that, right? We did already.
We like. I like passing for slightly younger.
Okay. But we had this. I had this play double this note with the trumpet. I knew he was going to be sharp.
Mm-hmm.
So every night I played the show, when we got to that note, I always just pushed my string a little bit and said, well, there's F, but he might be up around here. So,
yeah.
And then I quickly, like, listen, did I get it? You know, and it's like, oh, I hope I get the note tonight, because things do move around. You know?
Well, you know, we do have almost like a vernier scale on most decent trumpets.
Mm-hmm.
And we do auto correct.
Mm-hmm.
We can tell when we're going sharp.
Sure, sure.
Because we hear what... acoustically, or uh-huh. Just to change subjects
sure.
a little, do you ever notice that you don't notice how loud it is when you're performing, but when you get home, your ears are ringing?
Oh, my God. Well, you know, as I get less young, let's put it this way, that's what we're talking about, I'm more and more sensitive to loud sound. And very often at gigs, I'll set my amp up and I'll set it all my settings on my amplifier, test out my pedals, and I say, that sounds pretty loud, you know? And then the drummer goes crack on the snare drum, and I go, I'm not very loud. And after, like, you know, a couple of hours of playing with crack, boom, boom, you know, my ears are sometimes screaming on the way home.
Yeah.
So very often on the way home, it's WQXR on my radio.
Oh, that's nice.
Or some old Joni Mitchell CDs of her more acoustic things, just number one, it's beautiful.
The quiet sound.
Well, it's beautiful music, and it's also like a soothing balm for after having...
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, as much as I love to dig in and play bluesy and R&B type of stuff, it gets loud. You know,
so. It does.
Yeah.
Well, I was in marching band and then in orchestra, and...
They get loud.
Get very loud.
There's a lot of metal in those.
Bands. But you don't notice.
Right.
Because you're in the moment.
You're in the moment.
So you're going to play some Sam and Dave stuff.
Yeah, and I was thinking, you know, because the guy that played on most of those recordings was Steve Cropper, who is a buddy of mine. And Steve's one of the great Memphis guitar players of the era. He's living out in Nashville.
And let us not forget that he's a star in Blues Brothers.
That's true. And they still have the Blues Brothers. They're still out there touring.
Really?
All these years later, they're still out there. And a lot of the Blues Brothers guys are in New York. Lou Marini and Bones Malone. I don't know if Bones is doing it anymore. Leon Pendarvis. So, matter of fact, Leon's birthday was just, I believe, yesterday. So happy birthday, Leon.
Okay, cool.
And... But here's some Cropper type of stuff, like, let's think. There was one tune they did, which I always liked the guitar part. Of course, I can't sing this, because if I sang it, your show would be taken off the air immediately. But there was an old tune called When Something's Wrong with My Baby. And it just has some of that beautiful old Steve Cropper type of guitar, like... and then he just arpeggiated chords. One of his styles. And this makes me think of another song. If I may, I'm going to change key a little bit.
Go right ahead.
One of the greatest things that Cropper did, he played with Otis Redding also. And wow. And Otis did the whole thing where, I've been loving you too long. So if you remember that song, I'm not going to sing, but I've been loving you. Wait, hang on.
Go ahead, you can sing.
Why?
It's my show, George.
Let me get the key. I've been loving you. I'm not going to keep singing. But Cropper did this great stuff. Climbed up, but Cropper just went. Very beautiful style, very simple. One of Cropper's fills, the utmost of simplicity.
Sweet.
Etc. It was just, he played such beautiful...
I wish it would stop. That's always a problem. I get people in here and they play a couple bars and they say, oh, you know how the rest goes. No, just keep going, don't stop.
Well, I mean, I heard Otis singing in my head, but I don't know if you're a listening audience. They're just saying, I wish this guy would do something.
This is Burning Down the House with George Naha. If you just tuned in, we're talking about music and architecture and mostly about music, which is okay because mm-hmm. I think that all good architects should also be first in music. I mean, it's part of being liberally educated, and you can't be well educated if you don't know about music. I note in passing, out of a sense of obligation, my good friend and former vicar, I just learned today, Stephen S. Garmey, who was our pastor at Calvary Episcopal Church in Gramercy Park, passed away on October 4th. Mm-hmm. He did not have an obit in the Times, but it was mentioned in the City Room blog just a few days ago.
Mm.
And I've been thinking about him, and I didn't know why. I kept thinking, hey, I got to call Stephen. I mean, we should go out and have lunch. Well, that's not going to happen. We must always remember to take advantage of the day. And he was really a fantastic pianist, and he also had a great love affair with Russian suprematist architecture.
Oh.
He loved that period just after the revolution, during the Russian Civil War in the 1920s, where every bit of architecture and graphics was all imbued with the sense of a totally new order. He loved Russian art of that period so well that he learned to read and speak Russian.
Wow.
And took himself to Russia and snuck around like a spy taking pictures of buildings. He even apparently got himself arrested for taking photos of some structure that the Russian police didn't think that he should be taking pictures of.
Hmm.
And he also loved architecture. And as a middle-aged person, he got into Columbia Architecture School and got a master's in architecture just because he loved architecture.
That's
so
wonderful.
Much.
What a
Isn't
great
that fantastic?
That is fantastic.
And he was a really solid clergyman and a great friend to me.
Oh,
and
well.
I owe his widow, Jane, a little note because I'm rather sad that he's not with us.
And you're blessed that you had him as a friend.
Very much.
Mm-hmm.
Very much so. He baptized my younger daughter.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. And so, once upon a time, here's an architecture, architecture music sort of a story. I don't know where the kids were or their mom. They may have been off on vacation, leaving dad at home. And I tagged along with Stephen, and he took me to his friend, Dolph Plocek, Plocek, who was the librarian emeritus at the Avery Library, which is the largest architectural library, at least in the United States, and it's up at Columbia. And Dolph and his wife had a very nice apartment on the Upper West Side. Mm-hmm. And Dolph and Stephen sat down and did Handel for four hands.
Oh my!
And it was raucous. It was wonderful.
Uh-huh.
It was terrific. Here you had a landmarks commissioner.
Mm-hmm.
And a vicar who studied architecture, and they're just carrying on the Steinway there. And it was an amazing thing. I wish that somehow I could convert this memory into a video and share it with people. It was just incredible. And so here were two people very deeply steeped in architecture, and they were kick-ass pianists.
Well, it's interesting because a few moments ago you talked about a liberal arts education and a well-rounded education.
Yeah.
And that's a wonderful thing for people to get, and I think the opportunities for that are dwindling a bit.
I guess. College is so expensive that...
That's true.
Many of my younger colleagues are saying, well, if I had to pay what architecture costs now to get a degree,
right,
I wouldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you could easily spend $150,000. You come out, and maybe you'd get a job for $35,000,
right,
because they're not teaching you in architecture what you need to do in the practice.
I had a student. I taught for 18 years. I taught guitar at Fairfield University up in Connecticut. And 1 year I had a student, a guitar student, who was a pre-med major. He moved, and he said, the very first day of classes, one of the professors came in who was a very high-powered doctor. And he goes, who amongst you wants to go into medicine because you think you're going to make a lot of money at this? And a few people said, he goes, you know what? Leave school now and apprentice with a plumber. He goes, because you're going to spend so much money on your education.
Yeah.
And then you're going to have, once you start your practice, you're going to be paying these humongous premiums in medical malpractice insurance. And the way medical insurance and the healthcare system is, doctors aren't making as much money as they used to. He goes, apprentice with a plumber. You get your license, become a master plumber, buy your tools, and you'll never want for work.
That's true.
So it's sad but true. So
it's true. The people who actually know how to do things,
mm-hmm.
And things that are necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Really good car mechanics, for example.
Sure.
I mean, I was once on a. On a trip, actually, it was sort of my grand tour. I was going through Europe looking at architecture, mostly. I did spend a few days in the south of France where they had the topless beaches, but that was...
But you didn't look.
I did. And I got the suntan of my life, which is a very bad idea. Now I'm dealing with the delayed effects of that. But I met a young couple, and he was a Porsche mechanic.
Uh-huh.
And he was making huge money. Mm-hmm. He'd gone to mechanic school, specialized in Porsches, mm-hmm. and he was perfectly happy. He was there with his girlfriend. They were staying in a nice hotel, mm-hmm. and they were from our neck of the woods.
Oh, really?
They lived around a corner in Long Branch.
Wow, okay.
So, you know, you could be a car mechanic in Jersey and be staying at a really nice hotel on the Left Bank in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And who's to know, right?
Well, you know, I mean, some things you always need. You always need somebody that can fix your plumbing. You always need somebody that can wire your house correctly. You always need somebody that can get your car up and running.
That's right.
And those are valuable skills.
And it's sort of a pity that music, because it's everywhere, is somewhat debased.
Well, it's true. And it's somewhat an ethereal thing. I mean, it's not like... like this table, I could carve you. Well, I couldn't do it, but if someone could carve you this table, well, you could take this table home and have it in your house and say, this table. But music in its natural state just floats away.
That's right. Have you done any recording?
I've done quite a bit of recording over the years with a lot of different people, and it's always fun. I've produced some records. I've done arrangements. I've played with a lot of different people in the studio. So it's and done some TV shows and stuff with people.
TV shows?
Yeah.
Yeah, such as?
There was one really interesting one that... Now, this is a great music story, music business story. Years ago, a bunch of us went out to San Francisco to do this... it was going to be a live taping at Wolfgang's for this big TV special. It was a cavalcade of great musicians. You know, of course, Sam Moore was there from Sam and Dave, Wilson Pickett, Roy Orbison was on the bill, Mick Fleetwood was there, Weird Al Yankovic was there, Shirley Caesar was there. I mean, it was this humongous, wow. Great, great musicians. And something happened where we were at the rehearsal, and someone came and said, you know, they locked up all your hotel rooms because the producer hasn't paid any of the hotel bills yet. And we go, oops. And anybody get their per diems yet? We all went, oops. And the show never got finished. It was amazing. We actually recorded most of the show, but we didn't finish recording it. We never got paid. The show never was completed. I don't know who has the tapes of it. And about a month after the debacle, they allegedly found the producer lying dead in a hotel room with a huge bag of cocaine next to him. So this might have been where the money went.
It might have been where the money went. You just never know. Maybe he just found it on the bus.
That could be. Somebody just accidentally dropped it. And he said, what's this? Took it home and looked at it and died of fright. And, but I've done some things. You know, I've done some movie soundtracks. I actually played some of the tracks on, what was that movie? It was Welcome to the Dollhouse. Which was a kind of a cult. Actually, it was a big winner at a Cannes years and years ago, and it was kind of like a little offbeat movie that really took off. And I've played on some PBS specials. I did one with Alan Toussaint years mm-hmm. ago, which was a honor and a privilege to play music with that man. Because when you look at his track record of what he did down in the studios of New Orleans since the 1950s. Just incredible what this man has done, what he's written, what he's arranged, what he's produced, what, you know, it's incredible.
I would think that you could find some real good work working with Jim Jarmusch, or, you know, because he does, that dark stuff.
Yeah, he certainly does. It's beautiful stuff. You know, I'm still trying to, you know, it's interesting, for years I think... you know, I had my routine. I was teaching a couple of days up at this college. I had my private students. I was working around locally. And like we were talking before, with the economy kind of slowing down, well, the music business has taken quite a hit. You know, the recording industry has collapsed. And so I think, like with many industries, musicians are scrambling.
Yet LPs have come back.
That's a beautiful thing.
Which is interesting.
I've had some young students that have LPs, like their dad's old LPs of Hendrix and Led Zeppelin, and they swear they want to listen to those before they listen to the CDs or the MP3s. So
I cannot. I can't get over the pops and the noise.
Well, now it's interesting, and I wonder if it's psychological with people of our generation that grew up knowing that the stuff was, or some of us at least knew that the stuff was recorded on analog tape studios, and then when they mastered it and it got pressed onto vinyl, it did have a certain warmth to it. I think analog recording. Now, some people say it's distortion, where it warms it up a little bit, and the bass gets a little bit bumpier, and it seems to have a little, maybe not as clinical as early digital recordings.
Well, I have a friend who was a big Macintosh amplifier aficionado, and I mean, he loved the warmth that the tubes give.
Tubes are amazing.
And now, and these days, if you want to find an amp with tubes, you're paying a huge amount of money.
Right. Right.
And those suckers burn out.
Right. And that's interesting. All my guitar amps are tube amplifiers.
Uh-huh.
And I studied a lot over the past 5 years about tubes. And, you know, there's no more American manufacturers of tubes. RCA used to have big factories.
Yeah.
You know, GE, the Sylvania, they all manufacture tubes. They're all gone. And now most of them are either made in Russia or Eastern Europe or in China.
Wow.
And some of them sound pretty good. I don't know if the, you know, there was this very high standard of quality of in the manufacturing process back in the 50s and 60s with those tubes.
Sure.
I don't know if they're coming up to that standard anymore.
Well, it came out of the war effort. I mean, they had to make really good tubes because we had the first generation of computers. We had radar. That was all tube amplification.
Sure. Right.
There were no transistors till the late 40s.
It's true.
And you can hear the difference between something that's amplified with semiconductors and something that's a tube.
It's true.
It's not stripped down. There's something that happens to the overtones of the waveform that just gets clipped because it's going through a diode.
Right. And it's interesting, like the amp I use for most of my gigs is a I'll give a shameless plug to Mark Bartel of Baltimore, Maryland, and his Tone King Amplifier Company. But it's a beautiful old amplifier, and it's very responsive. Like, if I hit a note softly, sorry about the crunch, I have to clean up that
jump a little bit.
But if I hit a note softly on the Tone King, and then if I really hit one, that thing, I mean, it responds. It really does. That note that I really dug into snaps off that amplifier. It's like, wow. It's just this thing where a solid-state amp would never do that.
No.
And but so the with the tube in there and with the good circuitry, it's so it gets so responsive to your touch, and your dynamics just come alive when you brush a chord a certain way. It has this beautiful thing, and then you can snap a note, and it comes flying out of that cabinet.
So you never really got into rock?
Well, you know, I did for a while, and you know, I certainly loved Eric Clapton and Cream in those days, but it was interesting. By the 1970s. By the mid-70s, it was funny. I was part of the New Brunswick kind of jazz scene, and I started working with older black musicians. I was maybe in my mid-20s, and these guys that were in their 50s and 60s hired me to go play with them, and we were playing all these Chitlin' Circuit joints and playing like the R&B hits of the day and jazz standards and swing tunes, and cool. I did a lot of that, and and then I gravitated over towards doing the rhythm and blues and the soul music thing for a long time.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, about the most I get rocked out is crunchy. You know, I really don't, you know, when my sound gets crunchy, that's about as rocked out as it gets, you know.
So you never got into those crazy amps that had the propeller on top?
No, you know, my idea of a good amp has it. If there's more than about 4 or 5 knobs, I get scared. I've played through some amps. The more you turn the knobs, the worse the thing gets. And you can't figure out, how do I get it back where it sounded just like bad but not terrible? You know, so, I mean, every time I would turn a knob, I'd do more damage. It would go, oh, my goodness, what's going on here? You know, so I never got with that. Simple's good for me. You know,
that's all right. I think it was about 1969.
Uh-huh.
Springsteen had a band out of Freehold called Steel Mill. And it's before Springsteen was Springsteen, but he was still a local hit.
Sure.
And they had, I think they were Marshalls, you know, with the propellers on top. And man, they're fucking loud.
Those things go way loud.
Yeah. Same act, though. You know, get all sweaty.
Right.
And, you know.
He is one energetic guy.
Isn't he?
He can still, I mean, I guess Bruce is in his early 60s, I'm imagining.
63.
Okay. And he can still, I mean, a lot of my friends are in his band now. And everybody I know that knows Bruce loves Bruce. They think he's just a genuinely wonderful guy. And when he performs, he performs. I mean, he puts on, you know, his music was never my favorite music, but I certainly admire what he's done. And when he puts on a show, there's no denying that he just pumps it out.
Yeah.
You know, he can wear people out. He's just like...
Yeah, I've heard that. I've never been to any of his concerts. My sisters think I'm a freak because...
I've never been either,
They practically have tattoos with, well, they say, Bruce, which would be a little sick because that also happens to be my middle name, but...
They might think it a bit egotistical, yeah, you know?
Yeah, I understand his concert go for like 3 hours.
Yeah, and nonstop, he's just a ball of energy. It's like, you know, when I was with Wilson Pickett back in the early to mid 80s, we went down for a couple of weeks and down to Miami, and we split the bill with James Brown.
Wow.
And James Brown was not a young man at this point in time, and his shows were going nonstop for a good 2.5 hours.
Wow.
He started the week, he had two drum sets set up with two different drummers, and he would point to one drummer, and that drummer would play. And he's playing 3 or 4 songs, and then he would point to the other drummer, like, start getting ready, because this guy's getting tired. So the other drummer would maybe just start maybe with a little hi-hat, a little bass drum, and then he'd give him the second signal, and then he'd take over. Well, that wasn't enough. I guess James felt these two guys couldn't keep up with him. By the second week, there were 3 drum sets on the stage. So he needed 3 drummers to get through his show. But James, he was in his 60s at this point. You know, he was a short guy, and by that time he kind of had a pretty good gut, but he still had those little jumpsuits, which was an unusual look. But, it was his look, God bless him. And he was just stomping his feet and going for like 2.5 hours, not stopping. It's like, wow. You know, another thing of just a dynamo, you know.
Wow.
You know, and James Brown did bless me once.
Did?
He blessed me in Lexington, Kentucky. I was on the road with Sam Moore. Sam and Dave split up. I was with them when they split up. And I stayed with Sam as his MD for a couple of years. And I wrote out all the arrangements, all the charts, and we'd rehearse local bands. So we're in Lexington, and I had all my music on this table. We finished up Sam's show. And little did I know that table was where Mr. Brown, you're supposed to call him Mr. Brown. And he was sitting there being interviewed. And I said, oh, my God, I have to interrupt the James Brown interview to pick up my music and leave. And I walked up with great trepidation one step at a time. And he looks at me and goes, yes, may I help you? And I go, and I made him a great mistake, but he was very gracious about it. I said, James, I didn't say Mr. Brown. I said, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I have to leave and I have to pick up my music. And he gave me that huge James Brown smile. And he goes, I seen what you was doing for Sammy Moe. Sammy Moe need you. Bless you, son. Bless you, with that big smile. And I said, I've just been blessed by Soul Brother Number One, by the Godfather of Soul, by the new minister of the Super Heavy Funk. He has blessed me here in Lexington, Kentucky. I am a lucky man.
Yes, you are.
I walked away with my music. I don't think my feet were touching the ground. It was like, I was just blessed by James Brown, you know, so.
That is awesome.
It was a cool moment.
That is, That trumps any famous architect story that I have, or possibly ever will have. George Naha has been blessed by the king. Wow, that is fantastic. That's wonderful. we're near to our allotted time. Could you play another, you know, something that would be groovy? Sure. and let it run for a couple minutes?
Sure. Would you mind if I played something a little jazzier? Would
Please.
Okay. This is an old standard that I like to play sometimes as solo guitar, an old song called Tenderly.
Okay.
And just a nice little sweet song. Maybe we'll take out the day with that.
That'd be beautiful.
So let's see. Thank you.
This has been Burning Down the House on Heritage Radio Network with George Naha. Thanks for listening. Keep the faith.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.